You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, Togu Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producers Caden, Nicholas and Hannah. E whai aki nei, coming up on the show, I talk to ex-Karen Chaw about Three Waters reform and the government's decision to keep the mandatory 7-day COVID-19 isolation period in place. Hannah, what have you got for us today?
Today, for our weekly catch-up with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp, we talked about Manama Davidson announcing she will not be contesting the Tamaki Makaurau seat this year, where Takutai Kemp is running. We then discussed the government's changes to the Three Waters reforms, focusing on claims around co-governance.
Caden, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Colleen Brown on the findings for the new report by the Child Poverty Action Group. I also spoke to Sophie Hanford about climate resilience recovery for the regular Get Action segment.
Nicholas, who did you speak to today?
I spoke to New Zealand Nurses Organisation spokesperson Kiri Nuku about nationwide rallies that took place on Saturday, as well as the organisation's five fixes for the nursing shortage.
He aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395. Or Waia Mai Rane, give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero āno he pakihere Rocky Rocky Maurunga i ti pai tuku tuku o Edirangi Poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp.
For our weekly catch-up with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp, we talked about Manama Davidson announcing she is not contesting the Tamaki Makaurau seat this year, where Takutai Kemp is running. We then discussed the government's changes to the Three Waters reforms, focusing on claims around co-governance. I started by asking how Manama Davidson not running changes the electoral calculus for Te Pāti Māori.
I mean, first of all, we want to acknowledge Manama for all the work that she has done in our electorate in Tamaki Makaurau. And, you know, she's an amazing wahine. I mean, I know her here in Manurewa, and my role as the CEO is of Manurewa Marae. She lives here in Manurewa, and we're fortunate to see her out and about in the mahi that she does. So firstly, yeah, just acknowledge Manama and all the work that she does. And you know, we tautoko her and the stance that she's taken to support, you know, the wider campaign mahi for the Greens. And, you know, we wish her well in her space and on her next part of her mahi that she wants to do. In terms of her not running, I mean, they've put up a new candidate. And, you know, we need to respect that all candidates come with their own, you know, their own backbone, their own support network. And you've just got to take each day as it comes, and I actually look forward to the campaign and running with the new Greens candidate. Does it make it easier in terms of what it might be for Te Pāti Māori? Well, we'll only know on the day, because that's the day that matters when votes are counted. But in the interim, we must continue to raise and encourage our people to participate, to one, get on, to be enrolled, and then two, to participate in voting for this up-and-coming election. And we wish the new candidate all the best. And I'm sure we'll see her out and about across Tamaki Makaurau in her campaign.
I guess I was just wondering, because in 2020 the vote share saw quite a slim margin between Te Pāti Māori and Labour, like only 4% between the two candidates. And Te Pāti Māori has actually held the Tamaki Makaurau seat before in 2005, 2008 and 2011 before it swung to Labour. Why do you think the seat did swing to Labour?
Well, I mean, we were always up against a red tidal wave at the last election. And I do believe Jacinda is part of that. And we acknowledge her for her mahi as our Prime Minister. And so there was a strong red tidal wave. But we know that we can actually do very well and actually we could swing the vote back to Te Pāti Māori. There is a big chance that we could actually win this seat. And we feel that we can as well. So there are mechanics behind us looking at data, looking at areas that we can actually engage in and actually call back on those votes. I mean, yes, it does help that Marama is not standing, but what we want to do is encourage our people to vote.
Just moving on to the changes to Three Waters reforms that were announced by the government towards the end of last week. They're going from 4 regional entities to 10, pushing the start date back 2 years, but they're keeping the 50-50 representation of mana whenua on the oversight groups. What is Te Pāti Māori's position on these changes?
So I guess the changes are when we think about a council level, when I hear out here in Tamaki Makaurau from our communities, local boards, councils, they are happy with the change. It supports how they would like to see it working better. And I know that because I've also got a relationship with local board here. In terms of what that looks like for Māori, we still have the opportunity as mana whenua, as urban Māori, to have a say, but I don't believe it is the option in terms of what it could look like for Māori, especially when it's around water, when we say as Māori that we own the rights to water. However, it is a work in progress, and it's something that we need to keep, be more involved in and more aware of.
And with, you know, advisory groups, you always run into the issue of the entity in charge is always free to just ignore whatever recommendation comes, right?
I've been on many a recommendation groups, and actually where you want to be on is the decision-making group, and that's where we would see more of Te Pāti Māori being involved in that space. We want to be involved in the decision-making. Recommendations can be made anywhere, you know, in any policy. However, decision-making is where we need to be in any space.
And while the plan keeps the 50-50 representation model, the Prime Minister has stressed to the press that this is not co-governance. What do you make of that statement?
Well, you know, we are always about ensuring that Māori voices are heard. I know hapu iwi, and we would want to make sure that those are the voices that are in those spaces to be able to make those decisions for us. Being able to hear from our whānau, our hapu, our iwi, that they are in decision-making role, and that's where we would see Te Pāti Māori being able to push and drive that space. But our voices of our people are paramount. Whether the Prime Minister thinks that it's not co-governance, for us as Māori, we need to make sure that we are in a decision-making position.
I guess it's just does that statement that it's not co-governance kind of point to the issue having become a bit of a political football?
Yeah, and I guess what it does is it causes confusion out here in the community out here. And people just think it's just a change of words. But I guess, you know, at the end of the day, for Te Pāti Māori, we are very clear about where we see ourselves in decision-making roles and hearing the voices and representing our whānau, hapu and iwi.
And we've spoken before about how co-governance already represents a political compromise from Māori. You know, it's a step down from tīnoranga, tīratanga guaranteed in the treaty. Yet it seems the sticking point in all of the opposition to Three Waters this whole time has been co-governance.
Well, we're very clear what that is for us as Te Pāti Māori around tīnoranga, tīratanga. We will always strive for tīnoranga, tīratanga, that we are working towards mana motuhake. I mean, in terms of what other parties think or feel it should be for Te Pāti Māori, it is always about tīnoranga, tīratanga, mana motuhake for our whānau, hapu and iwi.
I guess it's just there's a lot of anger for something that's already a compromised position.
Well, that's probably something the government needs to look at more. They need to listen and hear what our people are saying and asking for. I understand that it is something that they need to be able to find a way forward on, but for Te Pāti Māori, we're always clear about what it is for us around tīnoranga, tīratanga, mana motuhake.
What do you make of claims put forward by the National and ACT parties that co-governance is divisive or anti-democratic?
Well, the opinion is that National and ACT are all about separatism. They want to separate us from the decision-making, the ownership of our resource, our taonga, that are special to us as Māori. They've actually already stated those things about taking away those rights for us as Māori, you know, and separating us from that. So that would be our kōrero around National and ACT.
And just putting aside any treaty issues for a moment, I just want to bring up this quote from New Plymouth's mayor, who says that their experience in New Plymouth working with Mana Whenua on developing their water plans worked really well for their community, and that Mana Whenua contributed a lot of insights and historical knowledge, and that because of that he supports co-governance, you know, just because it works. And, you know, this quote kind of seems to point that there's a lot of practical benefits that would accrue to this anyway.
Yeah, well, that's really great that that's happening in New Plymouth. I mean, that's in Whai Debbie's area, that's her roke, and so those are good things. And Mā Tauranga Māori provides a platform, provides frameworks where we can work, I guess, in unison, where they've worked together with Mana Whenua. So it can work, but it's really about respect, how you respect each group's decision-making, how you come up with those decisions, and what you can agree to that is workable. It's all about a relationship and how well people want to come together and actually make it work.
That was Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp speaking about electoral politics in Tāmaki Makaurau and Three Waters.
That was our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chua.
For our weekly catch-up, I discussed with Karen Chua the government's Three Waters Reform rebrand affordable water and their decision to keep the mandatory 7-day COVID-19 isolation period for at least a few more months. I started off our interview asking what ACT thinks about the government's new proposal for water infrastructure management. What do you think of the government's new proposal?
Oh, I just think it's more of the same thing. It's just change the name to try and make people a bit more happy about it because of the pushback that's been going on over the last year or so. But the co-governance aspect is still in there, and that's a real issue for ACT, and we can't support this co-governance that's going on within the water reforms.
The government's new proposal still includes that 50-50 partnership between the councils and Mana Whenua, specifically on the strategic oversights group, which would appoint boards. The local government minister, Kieran McNulty, says that this partnership is partly due to the Crown's treaty obligation, so do you accept then that your view ignores the principles behind Te Tiriti o Waitangi?
Oh no, definitely not. I mean, we've always supported the tribunal and the way that settlements have been done in the past, and we've always supported that because it's two parties coming together in good faith and negotiating what their obligations are. But the way that this has been done, it's not been done in good faith. And Kieran McNulty saying that the one person, one vote democracy is not going to be in these new reforms just shows how much this has gone away from what the treaty actually was. There were specific lands, rivers and mountains that definitely it should have been redressed, but this hasn't been done in the right way, and this is actually very undemocratic, and ACT just can't support that.
So is ACT against Mana Whenua having a say on water infrastructure?
Absolutely not, but the way it's been done, it's just not right. And there are ways to have redress if you feel like you should have some form of voting rights, of having that governance level decision making. But this just isn't the way to go about it. And the 50-50 really bothers me in a way that we have absolutely no way of holding that site accountable, whereas if you elect a council member and they make decisions that people are not happy about, there's a way to address that through the voting booth. And this way, there's no way to address that through the voting booth, so we're not happy about that.
So then how would ACT allow Mana Whenua representation in these new water entities to allow an iwi perspective in decision making about water infrastructure?
I mean, that's something that needs to be addressed, and that's something that needs to be spoken about. But it needs to take all people with them on this decision making, and it needs to be open and clear what is actually trying to be achieved, so it can take people on board and on that journey. But at the moment, nobody feels like they've got a voice in this. It's just being done, and that's just not the right way to do it. So if there is a way that mana whenua and iwi do have says, we have stuff within the RMA Act where they do have a say currently. But this 50-50 governance is not the right way to do it.
But at its current form, ACT wouldn't support any partnership with iwi?
Not in the undemocratic way that it's been done right now.
I also wanted to talk to you about government's decision to keep mandatory 7-day COVID-19 isolation periods for at least a few months more. ACT has opposed this. Why?
Yeah, I just feel like we need to start moving on. We need to start allowing businesses to get back to normal. People are struggling to open their doors with this mandatory isolation 7-day period. We've always said for the last year or more that it should be tests. You should be able to test. So if you test positive for COVID, the adult thing is to stay home until you're testing negative again. But if you're capable of going back to work, you're testing negative. We don't see any reason why you shouldn't be able to go back to work and allow businesses to start getting back to some normality. People need to start being treated like grown-ups now. COVID's going to be around. It's not going to go away. And we need to be able to make adult decisions.
Epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker has stated that we're entering a fourth COVID wave. Do you accept that isolation is an effective measure in managing spread, keeping case numbers down, and also reducing pressure on our hospitals?
Yes, I definitely do think if you've got COVID, you should be staying home and you should be isolating yourself from others. We're not saying that you shouldn't be doing that, but what we are saying is that this is going to be around for a long time, and people are going to have to learn how to make adult decisions and make those decisions for themselves, and businesses need that assurity that they're not going to lose staff members for this whole time if their staff members are capable of coming back to work. The other issue, though, is that how long do we continue this for? So it's not like they've said when we address it next time that this is going to disappear. It's just going to be looked into. And people just want some certainty about what they can and can't do. And what's going to happen is people are just going to stop testing themselves, and they're going to stop telling people that they've actually got COVID. And isn't that a worse thing?
So would you support then a model that allowed people to self-test, and then if they came up as negative, they could go into work, but if they came up with positive, what sort of isolation time would you want people to have to abide by?
Yeah, so they've said the 7 days from when you've tested positive at the moment. So like, if you're testing positive, you shouldn't be going into work. You shouldn't be you shouldn't be putting other people at risk. But if you're testing negative, most definitely you should be able to go back to work if you're testing negative before the end of the 7-day period.
So then how would ACT ensure protection for our vulnerable communities and also reduce pressure on the health system from the increase in COVID cases we're seeing at the moment?
Well, under that scenario, people would still be testing. So if you were positive, we'd still be saying you should be staying home if you're testing positive. So under that scenario, it's the same protections that are already currently in place. It's just that we're treating people like adults and allowing them to make those decisions.
And currently, boosters are being encouraged, but they're only available for people 30 and over. What do you think about this?
Oh, yeah, there should be an option for people if they feel like they want to go get that booster. Options should be available for them and encourage people, just like the flu jab. If you want to get that, then it should be available.
Would you support it being available for people under 30 or over 18 or even children?
Yeah, well, that actually also depends on the medical advice, right? So it depends on what the booster jab actually is. Is it the booster jab that protects us from this new variant, or is it the protection that protects from the original variant? And so I'd like to have probably the health advice on what the booster actually contains and if it's actually going to protect us from the new strains that have come out since.
That was ex-Karen Chaw speaking about free waters and COVID-19 measures.
That was our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. A report from Child Poverty Action Group has found measures to address child poverty are leaving behind Māori, Pacifica and disabled children, as well as children of solo parents. The report has signalled that despite some progress, child poverty rates in Aotearoa mean we are still failing to recognise the legal right of the child under the Articles of the UN Convention. I spoke to Colleen Brown, disability spokesperson for the Child Poverty Action Group, about the report and what it means for Aotearoa. A Child Poverty Action Group report has found that even when poverty is addressed, there have been significant inequities with Māori, Pacifica and disabled children. Why do you think this is the case?
Well, I think it's an intergenerational thing in many ways. It's been around for a very long time and it's systemic. It's very difficult to kind of tease apart, but one thing folds into another. And you would have seen in the report how we've got overcrowding, poverty, food insecurity, housing issues. You know, some years ago, if you were bringing up a child with a disability, you would be, you know, having quite a high level as far as a waiting time. You would be seen as a priority for Kāinga Ora, formerly known as Part of New Zealand. These days, that there are so many other people ahead of you in the list that by having a disability or a disabled child, or being a disabled parent yourself doesn't automatically mean that you're seen as a high priority. And this has happened. This is not an overnight sort of occurrence. This has happened over many, many years. So we're seeing just now, and, you know, I'm really pleased that it has got the prominence that it does have, and it should be front and centre of every single politician's mind and energy, really. If we tackle child poverty, then we're just going to make life that much easier for every single person in this country. And I think it's something that all of us as New Zealanders feel ashamed, really, that we have a country that has so much, and yet we have a significant cohort of people, particularly Māori, Pacifica and disabled, who seem to sit outside the system or where we would prefer to see people enjoying their lives.
So what do you think is the solution to address this inequity?
One of the key things is that in the disability sector, a lot of people tell us what they think are the issues. And we have to come back and talk to the actual people who are in these situations, who don't have enough food on the table, who don't have adequate housing, and who are disabled. We've got to start talking to the families who have disabled children. And most importantly, and I've been going on about this for years now, we have to collect data. We don't have the data to inform us of how many houses do we actually need to house disabled people going through to when they are adults? How many children are coming through the system who have a disability? How many Māori and Pacifica children are living in houses, accommodation of any kind, emergency accommodation? How many do we actually have of these people? We don't actually collect the data. And that's what really, really concerns me, is that without data, you can't plan. In addition, I think the report looks at how not only local government, but central government need to come together to tackle this issue. They've got to work collectively, collaboratively with organisations out there in the front line. But I would go further and say individual government departments really need to get their act together and share information. They've got to have systems that can share information and act on it and have really well-informed plans and programs that can tackle this issue. I keep on coming back, we're only a country of 5 million people. Surely we can get this right.
So you're part of the Child Poverty Action Group. Why should the issue be framed as child poverty rather than family poverty or poverty in general?
Well, I think, I mean, central to all of this is that children don't actually have a voice. And so we have to make sure that their needs are heard in a manner that is dignified for them. And oftentimes, too, if you are in a poverty situation yourself, you are so busy putting food on the table, making sure there is a roof over your head at night, that you can't think beyond that. And advocating for your own situation is beyond your energy. I'm part of a number of groups on social media for disability. I have a son who's intellectually disabled. And you see the comments on social media about what people are enduring on a day-by-day basis. Navigating systems which are so unfriendly, so problematic for us, is, you know, it's inexplicable in many ways. Like, get rid of the bureaucracy around some of the issues that we face. Make it easy for people to access information, access agencies, access support. And whilst I put my hand up and say this government has done a lot in the disability sector, but it is no good, for example, assessing a child and saying this is what you need if you can't supply the need. So if you need a physiotherapist but there's no physiotherapy available for you in your town, district, whatever, or you respite care, but there's nowhere to go to get the respite care, then we actually need to do a lot more. And this is where I come back to my idea about planning through data. If we know what we are going to expect with our children and what their needs are, then we can, what sort of capabilities we need.
Central to the report is that it says we're failing to meet our obligation to the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. Why should New Zealanders be concerned about that?
I'd be shocked if New Zealanders weren't concerned about that. I think the majority of us, if all of us should be concerned about the welfare of our children. What sort of society are we if we don't look at the most vulnerable of our children and not want the very best for them? And this is a community hearts and minds thing. If you see a child and you know that they're going home to an inadequate housing, no heating, poor food, wouldn't your heart be concerned about it? Your head, your mind be concerned about this? And don't forget, Article 2 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child talks about physical, mental, spiritual, moral and social development. We have to be concerned with all of those things. And if I'm concerned for my own children about those things, I should be concerned for every child.
That was Colleen Brown on a recent report from the Child Poverty Action Group on how some groups of children are still being left behind and why children need to be centred in discussions of poverty in Aotearoa.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
On Saturday, nationwide rallies were held in order to raise awareness about the nursing shortage and to urge politicians to help secure better working conditions. It was the first time that the New Zealand Nurses Organisation had called on all of its 57,000 members to rally at once. I spoke to organisation spokesperson Kiri Nuku about the rallies, their five fixes for the nursing crisis, and how the public can support nurses.
It is because we are sick and tired of nurses not being central to the discussion around our workforce We're tired of the government continually not listening and saying that there isn't a nursing crisis, and frontline workers standing up and showing the government that they're united and that these staffing issues are real. We had a reasonably good turnout around the country. I mean, bearing in mind that many of the nurses, if they're not on their day off, they're spending time with family, or many of them are at work. But across the country, I think we had a reasonably good turnout for the first time that we've come together like this.
And talking about Parliament, did you receive much response from local MPs, or was there a large contingent that turned out to support the rallies? Were they there at all?
Yeah, so across the country we had different members of Parliament turn up, and we also had mayors of the cities turn up. You know, this was also about raising the profile or the issues amongst the community. So we did have a scattered approach, I guess. Some politicians were there, and certainly some mayors of their cities were there. So that was a really good thing to see.
I read that over 5,000 nurses have registered to work in Australia since August. So can you give some insight into the difference in conditions between what Australian nurses are working in and what New Zealand nurses are working in?
Yeah, so absolutely. We don't know how many of those 5,000 have gone over, but what we do know is that many of them are being lured by the prospect of better pay, better hourly rates, and better working conditions. And I think because you're going into a different country, I think nurses feel more valued than they do over here in New Zealand, where they're completely, constantly being undermined. So the pay, working conditions, the opportunity for alternative ways of working, professional development opportunities, those are the lures at the moment that are drawing our nurses out of the country.
It's pretty saddening. Have you heard of many horror stories about nurses and the conditions they're in, and the type of hours?
I think there's lots of stories. I mean, we're hearing all the time about nurses turning up for work and having to stay on and do extra hours because the nurses that are meant to come on or rostered to come on behind them have either taken ill or a family member has been ill. So they're working in a really crisis situation, unable to do planning often because you're backfilling when your colleagues can't be there. But the stress and the mental fatigue that this has, and we've talked about this going into a winter months, and there's more likely to be respiratory diseases, respiratory conditions around that impact on community, but also nursing staff themselves. So we've seen a real shortage of the ability just to get nurses to work. And so that fear of not knowing what the workload's going to look like, not fearing if the fear of not having an adequate staff to be able to provide the quality of care that patients deserve, there's that's distressing for many nurses. And yeah, pretty anxious time.
Yeah, and I think you touched on a very important point, and that is that people think that nurses' understaffing affects only nurses, and it's an issue for only nurses. But the wider effects of that affects the community is actually quite crazy. And could you elaborate a bit on why understaffing is an issue that affects not just nurses, but also patients?
Yeah, so if say for argument's sake, if you had an injury at home, and the first port of call should be your doctor, but often you can't get into your doctor because they've got waiting lists, or they'll say, we're really busy, we've had to downscale our hours because we don't have enough staff, so you have to go to our emergency clinic. So you can sit there for hours in the emergency clinic, and you also then will be charged a fee. So there's crisis out there at the moment in primary healthcare, which should be the ones that could immediately provide emergency medical care. So others will use the alternative option and maybe go into the ED hospital department, who are also backlogged because of short staffing, increase in patients using ED as an emergency department to access. So we've got this issue where it's blocked from a primary healthcare emergency access, and then the system gets blocked up because patients will be either waiting for a long time in the ED, waiting till beds become available within the hospital, and everywhere is jammed up. So it has a knock-on effect. And then we've got issues where patients may not go to ED, wait at home because they don't want to be sitting around waiting, and therefore they complicate things further because they probably should need treatment or to have medical or nursing eyes upon them, but they're waiting at home. So everywhere the system's jammed up, and that's why it's a crisis for nursing, it's a crisis for doctors, it's a crisis for pharmacists, for physios,
you name it, it's across the health sector. It's a real problem.
Part of the rallies as well is the New Zealand Nurses Organisation announced their list of five fixes: actualisation of the Treaty of Waitangi within the health sector, getting more nurses across the health system, making pay conditions fair and meeting nurses' values and expectations of those, earn as you learn programs for nurses in training, and a push for more Māori and Pacifica nurses. Can you elaborate on why the organisation deemed these to be appropriate list of five fixes and how you want to see them materialised in policy?
Sure. Well, the Te Tiriti of Waitangi one is obvious, right? There is a commitment that needs to happen to tangata whenua, and that needs to be authentic and not just paid lip service. At the moment, we see the health system, and I think a couple of weeks ago there was an announcement that out of all the people that had kidney transplants, right, there were small numbers of Māori compared to the large numbers of non-Māori that qualified and had kidney transplants. Now, when you look at that, there is an overabundance. Māori are overrepresented in renal diseases. So why would the number or the people that have had these type of treatments be so limited unless there's some structurally discriminatory practice that happens that determines who gets treatment and who does not? That's why actualising Te Tiriti of Waitangi is important, to ensure that there's institutional racism and discrimination because of your culture doesn't continue. So our organisation is pushing in on that to make sure that we address these issues of racism within the sector. The Y2575 Kaupapa Māori Health Inquiry clearly articulated that there is problems. So we want to make sure that we're part of the fix. In terms of recruitment and retention, absolutely, it's a no-brainer. If we've got nurses that are leaving the country, we need to look at how we can support them to retain them. Some of that is about making a great program better and supporting them by funding, earn as you learn. Those types of opportunities must be made available to all to attract them. In terms of the Māori and Pacifica work, you know, World Health Organization and Association has said that for to represent our Indigenous populations best, we need a workforce that represents the percentage of Indigenous. So at the moment, we've got 7% of a workforce that identify as Māori. We've been 7% of the total nursing workforce since 1990. Nothing's moved almost 20 years later. So there has been no initiatives, and we want to see that that number increases significantly so it does start to match the population of Māori with across the country. At the same time, we've seen our internationally qualified nurses back in the 90s represented almost 13% of the workforce. Now they're up to almost 30% of our workforce is reliant on internationally qualified nurses. That's why that earn as you learn, let's keep them, let's retain them, let's support them in their training, let's just support them to get jobs is really critical, because we have to be growing our own workforce. And that includes Pacifica, of which there is a larger population of Pacifica people.
100%. And you've also, as part of this initiative, just launched a petition that people can sign on your website. Can you talk a little bit about how the public can support your initiative and what the steps going forward will be for the New Zealand Nurses Organisation?
This petition is about calling on all political parties to say and commit to fixing the problem in the health sector. We're always going to need a health sector to stand up and respond to things like climate change, to things like future pandemics, and just daily business as usual, operations, cancer treatments, etc. So the system is broken now. So we want to know, how are the political parties, given this is an election year, how do they intend to fix it? And then we want members of the public, everybody, to sign the petition to say our health matters and we want to know what's going to happen. And then that way we can make the best informed decision around election time based on what good healthcare opportunities there will be out there post-election.
That was Kerry Nuku, spokesperson for the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, talking about Saturday's rallies and the need for government support to end the nursing shortage. We'll be back after a quick break. Keep it on the B.
Record Store Day, Saturday, April 22nd. Southbound is the place to be. No gimmicks, no frills, just the best selection of Record Store Day releases. In-store only. Saturday, April 22nd at Southbound Records.
But yes, I said, if that's your KPIs, then you can KP it to yourself. Yeah. Can I grab anyone a drink? We've got beer, wine, orange juice.
Can I grab a Negroni?
Ooh, a bit beyond my liquor cabinet, sorry.
All good. Just a mojito then. Or a Mai Tai would be good.
Yeah, sorry, it's just beer, wine or orange juice.
Oh, okay. Well, just mix those three together then. We can think of a name later.
Cocktail Corner. 5:30 every Thursday, only on 95 BFM Drive. Thanks to the Hollywood Avondale and Fling Premium Cocktails.
It's Get Action, The Wire's weekly check-in with Action Station Aotearoa.
The Intergenerational Climate Ambassadors have published an open letter on Action Station calling on MPs to implement a climate-resilient Cyclone Gabrielle recovery. The letter highlights the need for participatory democracy, listening to Indigenous voices, and land use planning as key ways to address the climate crisis. For Get Action this week, I interviewed Sophie Hanford, councillor, activist, and member of the Intergenerational Climate Ambassadors, on why she helped write the open letter. The open letter is calling for a climate-resilient recovery. What does that look like to you?
So it essentially looks like investing in a better future and not a bigger failure. So recognising that although Cyclone Gabrielle has obviously caused us huge, huge challenges, and it's very much a manifestation of a bigger challenge, which is the climate crisis and reducing emissions, that it also does, however, present an opportunity to build back better. And so it looks like I'm thinking about what we're building and where we're building it. It looks like too through our kind of adaptation and our response to crises like Cyclone Gabrielle in their kind of own in their own magnitude, that we bake in the mitigation of emissions and the accountability to reducing those emissions. It looks like participatory democracy, so making sure that we have opportunities and mechanisms for the incorporation of views of our public, and especially of mana whenua, and making sure that through our response and through what has been a really challenging time for so many whānau and for communities, that actually we can build back more resilient through centering what's most needed and the solutions that are held within those communities, especially on marae and within whānau who have understood how to live alongside and with the land for generations. Land use planning is crucial, so using land use planning and strategizing again, what and where we build and how we kind of catalyse, I guess, the use of different transport networks in different ways. So looking at, you know, free public transport, at public transport more broadly, looking at active modes of transport and how we build back better in terms of connecting our housing with amenities and doing that in a way that is low emissions. And also the baking in of community resilience is really crucial. So it's kind of like a very multifaceted approach, I guess, to looking at how we rebuild, instead of that rebuild just being super focused on infrastructure in the short term, that it's a longer term and more holistic approach to building communities that will be able to both stand up in terms of our emissions needing to be reduced urgently, and that's kind of the number one priority, but also in the face of an event like this, that they can be stronger.
So why this kind of holistic climate resilient recovery so important?
So if we think about how our communities are being hit now, and obviously the climate crisis is very much in our midst, it's not a future problem. Emissions are the highest that they've been. We've seen though over the last year that they've started to taper down. But again, we can't afford to let the climate crisis continue to kind of run away on us. And if we do, it's a treadmill that we won't be able to get off, and the future that will be running towards is not one that we'll feel proud to pass on, with, you know, rising temperatures, rising sea levels, inundation of our communities. And so a climate resilient response is not only important because of what it puts at stake in terms of the natural world and the environment, which we're already seeing be degraded, but it's also important in terms of us as people and as communities, because the climate crisis puts at risk, you know, the lives of our next generation, but also the lives of people now. And we saw that with Cyclone Gabrielle. So it's really important because, if we just reduce emissions but don't centre that kind of human and kind of animal and nature risk, but also opportunity, then there's the potential, I guess, to not to not capitalise on the opportunities that are presented instead of just responding to the immediate risk and potential for damage. So I think it helps us to frame it in a way that allows us to kind of get the best out of what is a pretty tough and can often be quite an overwhelming situation considering the scale of the climate crisis.
I mean, the scale of the climate crisis is huge. So why don't you think there is enough currently happening to move us into a direction of climate resilient recovery?
Yeah, great question. I think, again, when we look at the kind of approach that central government is taking currently, which is very much in line with global science, which obviously we appreciate that at least there's recognition of the fact that emissions need to be reduced by around 50% by 2030, and then we need to get to net zero by 2050. But there's an opportunity to go further and faster if we truly, I think, were to step into our responsibilities, both our Pacific Island neighbours who are experiencing the impacts of climate change every single day, and that's just their reality. They're having to live with it, but they're choosing not to drown but to fight. And so we have to, I think, fight alongside them and to think about how much resilience, you know, is being shown by communities who are on the front lines right now. And again, if we think about Cyclone Gabrielle, how much resilience was shown by the communities who were right in amongst that damage. So, I think that there is a focus right now on just keeping in line with that science and just reducing emissions kind of at a steady pace so that we can hopefully reach net zero by 2050. But there's way more opportunity, I think, to use our solutions to develop a really equitable, just Aotearoa, and also one that fulfills its obligations to the Pacific. And at the moment, it doesn't feel like the language nor the action is there to support that in a really transformational way. I still feel like we're kind of, tinkering around the edges a little bit.
So you're both a councillor and an activist. What do you think the role of being inside local government is versus the role of being an activist is in pushing for climate action?
It's almost one and the same, I feel like, to be honest. Like, my role around the council table, I'm still that activist, and that's my community's given me the mandate to do just that because I stood on a platform of climate justice and of the opportunities that the climate crisis presents for us to take the kind of action that will make our communities more resilient, and that's something we have to do right now. Otherwise, otherwise we risk this kind of runaway climate breakdown, which we just can't afford to see. So I think there's a real role, though, for having people who continue to provide that really strong mandate for our councils and central government to take the kind of action that I think quite a few people within those systems and those structures really want to take, but sometimes don't have the courage, or there's like a nagging fear of not being re-elected that holds them back, or they just have to satisfy as many voices, or they think that they have to satisfy as many voices as possible. So providing that strong mandate is really, really crucial. And I think there's also a role for people in council roles to take some of these solutions really seriously and to not just put them on the back burner because climate change to them may be a future problem. For example, land use planning, that's something that's been mandated somewhat by central government through the need to consider how our communities are growing and also how we support that with housing that is both situated in places that enable low carbon communities but also centre the need for us to be resilient in the face of sea level rise and coastal erosion. But it's actually local government, I think, which in that specific space hasn't been kind of bold enough or courageous enough to kind of meet some of those challenges that central government is calling on us to make happen and to respond to. So there is kind of a tension somewhat, but I definitely think local councils need to step up for sure and have a role to play in enacting a lot of this stuff, because if we want to also enable citizens assemblies, you know, participatory democracy, local government is quite ably placed to be kind of the responder to that and the enactor of some of those ideas and solutions that come forward as a result. So, I think they play a really, really key role in there as well.
That was Sophie Hanford on a climate resilient recovery to Cyclone Gabrielle. The open letter can be signed on Action Station.
Wow, important stuff.
That was Get Action on 95BFM.
That was The Wire.
Ko ere te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou e kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Axe, Karen Chaw, Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp, Colleen Brown, Sophie Hanford, as well as New Zealand Nurses Organisation's Kerry Nuku. Ne ra hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to our producers Hannah, Caden, and Nicholas. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.